This is Paul Nixon from Corporate Eye. Lucky enough to be interviewing Mark Hines from Transparency Matters. Hello, Mark. Pleasure to meet you again. Would you care to introduce yourself?
Delighted. Thank you again for asking me. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk. Yes, I run Transparency Matters Limited. We do two things. We do corporate investor relations training, and we also work for a number of providers to the investor relations community. And you can find more about us on our website.
Bravo.
These are the advertisements, folks.
So we're going to start off by talking about risk management in relation to good old corporate websites and communication of risk online. So, Mark, what's, first of all, the kind of minimum that you think companies should do, both on their website and potentially in their annual report?
Well, I suppose the first thing you've got to do is comply. And there are various compliance rules and regulations that are out there. Partly they're contained in the new governance code, which has a great section on risk. Partly they're contained in the Companies Act and the interpretations of that by the FRC. So there is a minimum standard, if you want to put it that way. And so therefore, I think those are things like the extent to which you measure risk, how you measure it, and the extent to which you discuss the mitigation of that risk, and who is responsible for it at the end of the day. So there are minimum things that you need to be able to explain and to do. However, the point about the website, I think, is that it can be used for all sorts of things that obviously are, for example, video. If there is an opportunity to identify a risk of flooding, if you're an insurance company, or something similar, then a picture tells 1,000 words and a video tells more. So the idea of explaining something through that kind of graphical output is very, very appealing. Similarly, you can refer to external data in a website, which you probably can't in a hard copy annual report. So there are lots of different advantages to different media. But fundamentally, to answer your original question, it is about compliance in some degree.
And what would you see as a split between the annual report versus the website? Is there some information that you would see should be on one and not the other, or would you replicate both? Or how would you, if it was your website and you were running a huge international conglomerate, how would you do that split?
Well, there are certain minimum things that must appear in the annual report. And one of the frustrations, I think, for a lot of companies at the moment is that there is relatively little clarity about that split. So, for example, one of the earlier drafts of the governance code talked about how to use your company's website to amplify the information that's on the in the annual report, in the hard copy fixed annual report. When the final thing came down, reference had been removed. So companies do struggle with the idea of understanding what can appear in their website and what must appear in their annual report. And the sooner we get clarity on that, I think the better everybody will like it, to be honest with you.
Mm.
So I think the split does vary. For me, it's about technology and what and how you can use it best. There's relatively little point in making text available through one when they can be available through both. The power of the website, of course, is that it allows you to use those new technologies, such as video, such as interviews, such as profiling, such as graphics and so on and so forth, and interaction.
But also time, because obviously your website's not constrained by the once-a-year approach.
True.
So do you see that the risk should be updated more frequently or on the website as opposed to your sort of once-a-year end-of-term report?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the challenges about an annual report, exactly as you say, is that it turns up once a year. We all know that communication with shareholders is something that goes on a 24-hour basis throughout the year. And so you go from real-time price-sensitive news releases through to the interim management statement, through to the half-yearly, and then to the annual report. And we've got investor presentations which are happening potentially weekly all the way throughout the year. So you've got a consistent story which is being told throughout the year. And the important word there is consistent. The need to be consistent on the basis of how that story is coming across. Risk, as we all know, is a very, very important part of the company's story vis-a-vis the investors, and keeping that risk story updated is crucial.
Mm. So what would impress you if you were looking at a website or indeed an online annual report? What would impress you or convince you that the company was serious about its risk management activities and about communicating it?
Well, I think the starting point is the company's attitude and appetite for risk. What is it that the company wants to do? It's clearly impossible to run a business without taking some form of risk. And so therefore, the question is, at what stage do you say that's too much risk? And so therefore, a statement of some sort which says, this is the kind of risk we like and this is the ones that we're going to take, is a good thing. The second thing is, who owns risk in the business? Is it the responsibility of the board? We've seen the Walker report require that the BOFIs will have a dedicated risk director. Are other companies going to follow suit? Are they going to have somebody dedicated on the board to risk? So ownership of the risk. The processes of risk are very important. How do you actually decide whether something is a risk, and how do you measure its impact on the business? How do you therefore decide whether this is a risk that's acceptable to run? And how do you then mitigate against that risk? So you've said, right, I understand this risk. Here are the things I'm putting in place to make sure that risk is going to have the lowest possible impact on the business. And then, of course, the detail of it. And we know different types of risk. We talk about environmental risk. We talk about financial risk. We talk about cash risk. We talk about all sorts of different types of risks. Every one of them has a different approach, and every one of them needs different explanations. But I think, for me, one of the keys to all of this is this word that we're using now, integrated reporting. Mm. Every aspect of a company's story has risk attached to it, potentially. We talk about management. What's the risk that management isn't going to be available to us? We talk about the product lines. We talk about the whole business model. Every element of that carries risk. And so, therefore, to talk about risk in a dedicated section and say, right, here's risk, let's talk about risk, whoa, there it is a contradiction. Risk should, in the opinion of many, and in the increasing opinion of many, perhaps, be integrated throughout the report. Whenever you talk about, you know, it might start off with the chairman's statement, for example, addressing the key risks that they're taking. The challenge, of course, with risks is, how do you report enough to keep the investors interested, and not enough to alert your competitors? It's a bit like sort of saying, you know, opening your shirt and saying, aim here if you do it wrong. And I think that's the difficult part.
Do you think that, I kind of see a linkage between, a growing linkage between the risk management part and the crisis management part, and about preparedness and verification that you actually have got the means to address, should your oil well leak, say, in a deep water, inaccessible place. So do you think people get that and get the need to bring those two parts together? Or?
I think, like all corporate reporting, there are some who are absolutely brilliant and have thought the thing through with great enthusiasm and in great depth.
Any you'd highlight?
Typical, I suppose. There are a few who I think are perhaps helpful to look at. Some of them are financial. Old Mutual, I think, does a particularly good job. I think 3i, again, you know, they are the kind of company you would expect to understand risk just intrinsically. Tullow Oil is another one that I would highlight as being somebody who's done a good job. So I think those across the piece, both on the annual report and on online, have done a good job. They thought it through carefully. Of course, the banks do a good job, and to be fair, Barclays and the others have done a bang-up job of using graphics to help investors understand how risks, what risk means to them.
Mm.
Whether or not that same approach will, and you know, at least a couple of the ones I've mentioned are BOFIs. Whether that will translate over to, you know, the broad sweep of companies who have done a good job on communicating that stuff. I don't know.
So with all these various pressures and new regulations and new papers on what people should be doing, and obviously one of the key ones being Walker, how do you think people have reacted? Do you think they've reacted well?
Well, I think everybody gets it. I mean, obviously, investors, if you go right back to the beginning of it, investors, and I suppose we always have to talk about stakeholders, all the stakeholders want to understand the risks of the investment and the, you know, the old calculations of beta, which you remember from years ago, are very firmly still on investors' minds. Where is the potential downside of this, and how do I measure that against the potential upside? And so investors and other stakeholders need to understand that. And so I think that's the, you know, that's the key point to make about that sort of measurement of risk, really.
Mm. And do you think the impact of BP, with all the traumas they've gone through and more greater focus on assessing risk and crisis preparedness, do you think that will have a bigger effect? Or
Yes, I think environmental risk is going to increasingly whiz up the chart in terms of, I mean, it's interesting to note that, you know, large numbers of people are spending a great deal more on communicating their environmental and CSR policies these days. Some of them are producing standalone reports, which are very, very helpful in providing insight into their policies on this. Some of them are mandated. Carbon outputs, for example, are an obligation. Some of them are just best practice, and you can see some really, really good ones. I mean, Rio Tinto does a super job in terms of communicating. I guess you'd say, well, they've got to, haven't they? Because of the nature of the business in which they work. But there are some good examples of that. But I think we're going beyond that now. It's interesting to note that GRI and others are working towards a standard which links financial information with environmental information through something called the XBRL. And so creating a taxonomy, and a language that's used to communicate that, which can then be processed automatically. So now you've got the potential, and I guess I might well be retired by the time this happens, but the ability to be able to process risk information electronically in the way that the company wants to portray it, gosh, wouldn't that be a great thing?
I've even heard of extending balance sheets to talk about environmental costs of
triple bottom line, and you know, yep. And I think that's right. I mean, that's not a new expression, but I think that's absolutely right. And there's some people produced a book the other day called One Report, some months ago, called One Report, and that idea of integrating information all the way throughout the company's story on risk and other things come to that is important. So. I think that, does that answer your question? Sorry.
Absolutely. Let's move on now and talk a bit about transparency. And it gets a lot of visibility. A lot of people want to be seen to be transparent. And yet with obviously certain information mandated through quarterly reporting or whatever, then the question always comes in my mind of how someone, if they say we want to be seen as transparent, what extra do they have to do? What convinces you that a company are going out of their way to be transparent and genuinely living and breathing that mantra?
Mm. Well, I think the most important word in that question is if, because there are a significant numbers of companies who frankly don't get it. They don't understand that there is a connection between the perception that investors have of them and transparency. And I do quite a bit of work in emerging markets and developing markets. And it's a question that comes up an awful lot from senior management as I talk to them. And they say, why should we be transparent? So it's not a given that every company wants to...
Some like to be a little more translucent.
Some opacity that will live. And so I think there is a great difference between companies. And so therefore, in terms of what they can do and the kinds of things, of course, you know, we talked about many of them. And I don't think there's any doubt now that in the UK we have one of the strongest governance codes the world's ever seen. And I think if one complies not necessarily with the boilerplate, but rather with the spirit of it, that kind of inquiry would open itself to investors very, very well. Providing that level of insight into the business would be very, very good. There's plenty of standards out there which allow people to communicate if they are of a mind to do so. Of course, using all the possible vehicles out there. We talked about annual reports, we talked about websites, we haven't really talked about social media, for example.
Mm.
Companies using blogs, companies using Twitter and all those other things to be able to broaden the means through which generations can get access to the information on the companies in who they're interested. I think that will grow.
So do you see the way that people have used social media, say in the States, extending over here from not just, we see them over here on CSR careers and so on, but we don't see them in the investor side or certainly not governance. Do you see that happening over here more? Do you see that as a key way of demonstrating transparency?
Yes, and you do see it, depending on how you define social media, it's easy to talk about things like Facebook and Twitter and all the other bits and pieces. For me, I think it's more about collaborative content. It's more about opening up the company to the ability to be able to discuss with its community. I was quite interested in this idea of sharing. So, for example, a number of companies, quite easy to do now, to point people off to a Facebook, point people off to Twitter. Go and comment about this. You've just spent loads of money winning a new pair of eyeballs for your website. The first thing you do is say, well, actually, we don't want you, thank you very much. Do you want to go off and talk to some other means of communicating through the website? I think that's wrong. I think having won those eyeballs, you want to keep them as hard as you can. And so now we're talking about people making things like Facebook native to their websites, allowing them to build a conversation with the company.
Mm.
In an online environment, using some of the tools that people are familiar with, such as Twitter, such as Facebook. So yes, I think we're going to start seeing some of that, and some of the companies who are doing best at it. And you're not going to ask me to name a name, and
I've seen Centrica feedback. They feedback their data from their blogs back onto the website.
Yeah.
I haven't seen anyone do it in the IR space, and definitely not in the governance space.
And not certainly not in the UK. I have to say, the Americans are significantly further ahead than the UK on using these things. Why people aren't Twittering the fact they've just posted their results, I don't know. It's a dead simple thing to do.
Some are now, but using it as a push.
Exactly. And then you can start talking about sort of other types of technology as well, such as video.
Mm.
I'm quite interested by the stat that I read the other day that one third of all American companies now have electronic access to their AGMs. So they have a kind of a mixed AGM. They've got some which is online, live, and they've got some which is in physical. There have been a couple of companies that have said they're going to hold entirely virtual AGMs. So actually, no drafty hall, no sandwiches, no gifts, entirely available online only with now approved voting technologies. So now you've got the ability to just sit at home and grant your proxy to somebody or other or vote yourself.
And tweet in your questions.
So, we're dealing with an entirely different type of technology as well, which I think is going to be very, very... So I think transparency, getting back to the point about that, A, it's not an assumed all over the world. B, the technologies exist to make it, should you have made that decision, to make it such. There is still, among many directors of public companies, concern about sharing too much information. And I do think that will take a long time to resolve. You can't expect people to give away the company store if there is this magic bullet that makes the company make money. Why would you discuss it and what you're going to do to it in the future in public.
Mm. So where's the guideline? Where they, and they have to judge on that and be judged on it.
Yeah, I mean, the difficulty, of course, is that you can't talk about it in private to an investor unless they become an insider. And so, therefore, it's something that you're going to want to develop and nurture inside the business, and only when it's a fait accompli at some point in time. But, you know, things like R&D investment, you know, how do you explain it? How do you account for it? Mm. You know, most companies say, right, we've got a research and development budget, and here's how we're going to do it. And we're going to capitalize it or we're going to expense it, whichever it is. And that does what it does. What it doesn't do is relate it to, for example, the number of patents you've registered in many instances. It doesn't explain what you've actually, what success rate you've had. You know, 100 out of this $1 million has succeeded. The rest has been a complete waste of time. But that message about communication of those kinds of things, the hidden assets, you know, brands, how do you put a proper valuation on a brand? Mm. How do you put loyalty of staff on the balance sheet? Things like that. It's that kind of transparency that I think investors would love to be able to see, and it's awfully hard to do.
Indeed. So let's move to a slightly wider sphere on governance as a whole. So what do you think of the kind of standard of governance sections on websites as they are at the moment, and how good a job people make of those?
Frankly, appalling in the vast majority of cases. It's very, very hard when you're looking for a company whose website contains a good governance section to actually find one. There's very, very small numbers. Marks and Spencer's are probably as good as it gets as it stands at the moment. And so therefore they've taken the approach of I think they call it from the boardroom to the shop floor. Mm. It's a completely integrated program. So that's pretty good. No, the vast majority of companies take the view that if it ain't in the governance code, why should I be talking about it in my governance section?
So just going back to the Marks and Spencers example, what are the things that has that most don't, apart from the integrated approach? What are some specifics?
Well, for example, they've got a graphic which illustrates how they join the board to the shop floor. Mm. They've got a business model graphic which kind of lays it all out and says how all the bits fit together. They've got personal statements from each of the directors. It's not just your boilerplate. You know, Mr. Smith was a director of is a director of three other companies, and you know, so on. They've got some profiling of directors, which works much better in many instances. So there are a number of things, but I don't think Marks and Spencer's would say that theirs is by any means perfect.
So what would be your dream? The governance section you dream of at night.
well, I suppose there's a number of questions that boards might think about asking themselves. Mm. I mean, one question might be, what does governance mean for us? Introspectively, where does governance fit? What does it mean to us? What, obviously, there are policies and procedures and so on, but there is perhaps a... somebody's using the expression at the moment, the mandate. What is the mandate of the board to operate? How do we think about that? We might well ask ourselves what the board comprises. What is the team? Why do we think we've got a suitable balance of skills? And it's awfully easy to sort, as I say, to put up simply a template of, you know, four lines of each description. But why is the board more than the sum of its component parts? Mm. Why does the skills that each board member brings, and nobody ever talked about those, by the way, very few, say this person has experience in North America, North America is a jolly important market to us, therefore we've got this person on board, and they add to that. But nobody discusses that, or very few do.
Because they don't want to bring it out, or they haven't thought of it?
They just don't think of it. I do think that a lot of it is very driven by compliance, and the code makes that point right up front. It says, it describes it as the fungus of boilerplate. And I don't think that many companies want to go beyond that in some instances, because they don't see the need to do so. But I'll come back to that point because I think that need is quite important at the moment. So you've got that kind of thing. What have we done? How do we measure ourselves? What are the things that we know? What does success look like, if you like, in that instance? I was on a panel session quite recently on board evaluations, for example. The big word is culture. How do you get across the board meeting and how it works?
And the challenge involved.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And one thing that a lot of people are talking about at the moment is the board evaluation. The new code says that the board must be externally evaluated every 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Terrific. But what an opportunity to express what the board structure is and how culturally it all fits together. And so, you know, an external evaluation might agree with the board what the process should include, what are the things that people are going to ask, individual interviews, the creation of a report, and so on. And then agreement of targets as to what needs to change as a result of those interviews. So there is quite a formulaic process, and a lot of companies are good at describing that process. Almost nobody is good at describing the outcome.
Yes, and what they've changed.
And none that I can think of actually then go on to say, well, we said we'd change this, and here's what we've changed, and here's the result. Nobody does it. And so therefore, I think there's a great process of all of that. So I think at the end of the day, governance is about people. And another challenge, I think, for companies is the fact that the governance, it's about who owns the governance section of the annual of the report, whether it's an annual report online or offline. In many instances, of course, it's the company secretary because that's there. But I don't think many company secretaries would argue that they're hugely well-trained communicators always, and so therefore, that's perhaps part of the reason that good governance reports are a rarity. Who owns the governance report? Well, the board thinks they do because it's about them. Corporate communications would love to be able to do it because they realize the value of good governance within a company in terms of building brand and doing all those things. IR thinks they should evolve because a lot of it is what the investors want to know. And so if the investors want to know it, IR has an interest in it. And of course, the company secretary knows that they own it. So it's a difficult trying to map all of those influences and all of those opinions into a single governance report communicated well is tough.
And then taking it one step further and actually making a decent governance section that is seen as interesting, engaging. Sexy is probably taking it too far.
Just a touch. But you see, I don't know quite why we're talking about a governance section. I go back to the remarks we were talking about earlier with risk. I don't see why governance isn't built in throughout the report.
Hmm.
Why, I mean, the chairman talks about governance, but in a fairly light touch way. Rarely do they talk about what governance means to us, for example, and yet that's a terrific place to discuss that. So every section, the business model, the new governance code talks about the need to have a business model and to discuss the basis on which the company makes money. So few companies actually do that.
Mm.
And so therefore that is good governance. How do you apply that to so all the way down, the structure of a logical story, a company's equity story, you can discuss the implications of governance on that bit. But no, what we do is we take all of the governance bits, we follow the nice combined code, governance code, my code as well, and we create a formulaic report. Section A1 says we must do this, and that's what we do.
Mm-hmm.
It therefore becomes impenetrable for the average punter.
I mean, I almost see that you want to be able to slice and dice it both ways. So you want to be able to, for those people who are interested in risk or those people who are interested in governance, to have a section or a place where they can go and read about
Absolutely.
It. But at the same time, I certainly take your point of you need to read about any given subject in the full context.
And I think that's right. And you know, there's nothing wrong with putting all sorts of additional content on the website, particularly because it can... it's got the ability to hold the kind of volume that is necessary. If you've got a policy on whistleblowing, not part of the governance code, it's not part of necessarily a disclosure, but gosh, it's what everybody would like to see in lots of instances. So lots of different policies, you know, the spirit comes through. So I think that's a place in which that can all happen.
With the new UK corporate governance code, how would you summarise the key changes that's going to make in communicating governance?
I think that a lot of the important bit of the new governance code is actually not in the governance code itself, or indeed in the reorganisation of the sections, which is one of the most obvious parts of the code. It's actually in the preamble, and it states what the what good governance looks like, and it gets back to this word culture. There is a determination on the part of regulators to make companies discuss how their board actually works. Somebody described it to me as being a way of communicating the fireside chat. Chairman loved the expression, and it's a very evocative description of a couple of chaps sitting around with a large whiskey and a roaring log fire and talking about the prospects for the business. That, for many companies, is the best form of governance. So you suspect that the FRC and the people who have written the governance code would like to see that image translated more into a physical environment.
Yep.
That kind of communication, that soft, intellectually rigorous kind of discussion, moved into an online environment, it's going to be awfully difficult to do. And I don't think we've even begun to scratch the surface. One of the things that I think I would also describe as being important about the governance code is this comply or explain. It's going to come under a lot of attack over the next few years, from Brussels particularly. We've already seen the governance proposals for financial institutions. And it's clear that the European Commission has its sights set on something other than a comply or explain regime. Whether you want to call it nice emotionally a Sarbanes-Oxley for Europe or not, I don't know.
Mm.
But something that relates to fixed rules, thou shalt do this, is probably what they would prefer to have. And that will progress or it won't. So I think the governance code has put up a terrific stout defense of comply or explain. The risk, of course, is that companies will choose not to do either. And so that will rearm that argument in Brussels.
Or they'll comply to the boilerplate checklist, as many did before, the famous casualties of the last 3 years.
Yeah.
You know, they could have ticked that combined code list.
And there's a point that I was going to make earlier that I said I'd come back to, and that is in respect of the proxy voting agencies. The number of investors, particularly in the new stewardship code environment, that are choosing to outsource their governance voting procedures is growing. And largely they do a pretty good job, I think, of making sure that the views of the investor are captured and are voted appropriately, and so therefore that outsource works. It does, however, create a new community that companies need to communicate with. And the idea that a fixed template of, again, tick the box, can work for all companies, which is, and we see that many of the proxy voting agencies will publish their policies and guidelines for the next year, and they do that. A lot of them have just done it, sort of in October, November time. And the idea that those can be somehow retrofitted onto every company, I think a lot of directors of public companies have a problem with that as a thought. The community that is very important for the communications perspective now is the proxy voting agencies, are the proxy voting agencies, I should say. And so I think that needs to be borne in mind by companies as they're designing their communication strategy as well.
And so what particular flavours or things do you think they should, in addressing that community, that they need to do?
Well, obviously you should reach out to the companies that provide those services on a direct basis. But equally, you should make as much governance reporting as accessible as possible. I think it would also be useful to retrofit some of the questions, the policies, and it's a useful thing to check back and say, hey, do we comply with this or do we explain? And if it's we need to explain, have they actually explained? Because one of the things that will count against a company is if the proxy voting agency has a question relating to X, and that explanation isn't to be found either on the company's website or in the annual report, just mechanically, that will be marked down as a zero.
Mm.
So it's a useful thing to go back and say, right, let's have a look at that report. The guidelines from the proxy voting agencies, and we'll go back and say, right, I'm now looking at it through their eyes. Where do I find that piece of information? How easy can I make it for them to actually find it and to be able to do the simple thing of ticking the box?
So that kind of leads nicely to my final question, which is about where you think things will go and how they'll develop further in the current debates and evaluations around the various codes. How much further do you think it will be taken, or what sort of developments do you see happening in the next few years?
On governance? Well, as I say, I think the thing that, you know, corporate Britain has to do is to stand up for the comply or explain regime. We know that that's the best method, so I think that's the first thing.
We know we're right, goddammit.
We know we're right, and we know that this process works better.
Yeah.
We know that from America. You know, Sarbanes-Oxley is a beast, and there are various bodies in America who are saying, gosh, I wish we hadn't done it. And so therefore we recognize that it would be a mistake to go down the fixed regulation route. Thou shalt have these numbers of these things. So I think that's the first thing we've all got to do.
Mm.
Second thing, of course, that we're all wrestling with at the moment is this word engagement. There is an immense amount of pressure on companies and investors to engage. And as we speak, I think 68 companies have signed up for the engagement platform with the FRC.
Mm.
And so therefore, that I think is a good sign. It's a good start. It's not easy for investors, institutions who own 350, 400 companies in their portfolio to stay across all of them. Many of those investors don't actually have anybody focusing on governance. They outsource it in many instances.
For those who aren't familiar, how will that engagement platform manifest itself?
Well, that's really it's about discussion, and the stewardship code itself lays out a number of things that investors should do in order to comply, or they have to say why they haven't complied.
For instance?
Number of times you've spoken to the board of directors, for example, number of times you've met with the company in different ways, in what form was that meeting undertaken? Was it a telephone call? Was it a physical meeting, et cetera, et cetera? So what did you discuss? Discussion of X numbers of things.
Mm.
So there's a huge pressure, it's probably the wrong word, but there's a huge demand for investors not simply to sit there and own the shares, but to actually engage themselves in how the company is governed. And, you know, we've now seen more recently a consultation come out from Vince Cable at the BIS, which talks about how corporate Britain can become more of a stewardship environment. How can we avoid this sort of short-term trading, and obviously part of the thought is that that's driven by Cadbury and the and the number of people who shorted the stocks. How can we create a culture of engagement and involvement by the people who own the shares and the people who run the companies? And that's going to be one of the big things that comes out in the future. A long way to go on that particular topic. And investor relations, I suppose, would argue that, gosh, that's what I do for my day job, isn't it?
And no doubt we'll come back to that one in a year or so's time.
Indeed.
So, Mark, thank you very much for your time and your deep thoughts.
Thank you very much, Paul. I appreciated the opportunity.